tuned to Yesterday, featuring programs from radio's golden years. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Coming up in this hour, True History. Later on, Up for Parole from 1950 with a true story. But first, it's Night Watch, one of the most unique programs of radio's past, as you ride along with the police on actual cases and crimes. This CBS episode first heard on April 12th, 1954.
Five, six to Control 1, reporting in service. Starting mileage 7833, 7833. Officers Perkins and Walter.
Roger, 5-6.
6:03 p.m., starting Night Watch.
This is Don Reed. I'm a police recorder riding with this detective unit just reporting in service on the Night Watch. You're going to ride with us tonight.
5-6, contact Lieutenant Lugo in car 50 at Washington and Overland. Regarding a 311.
5-6-10-4. We're in the area now.
A 311 is indecent exposure. We'll be on that case in just a few moments. But as I started to say, you're going to ride with us tonight and follow our investigations. And just remember one thing. The people you hear are not actors. This is it. This is real. This is what happens on the Night Watch.
Night Watch. The actual on-the-scene report of your police force in action. There are no actors, there is no script. Every voice, every sound is authentic. The investigations are recorded as they actually occur. Night Watch is presented with the cooperation of the Police Department of Culver City, California. W.N. Hildebrand, Chief. We switch you now to car 5-6, already on investigation in the field, and your police recorder, Don Reed.
We're approaching Washington and Overland Boulevard now, where we'll meet Lieutenant Lugo of the Uniform Division. Straight ahead, I can see his car parked in the gas station. Lights off, waiting for us. Here we are. Now, let's get over there and see what's up.
The reason I wanted to see you is that I have a complaint here from a woman. This particular man exposed himself to her, and I have the license number here. I've run the DMV on it, and this is the name and address of the person. I'm sure she can identify him, and I wonder if you and Walter will follow this thing up and go pick the man up.
Okay, right. You got the address, sir?
Yes, it's right on this piece of paper here.
Okay, fine. We'll go right out there.
Swell. You heard the lieutenant assign us to this exposure case. In plain English, this means we're going to pick up a suspect who evidently has exposed himself indecently in front of a woman victim on a public street. So, let's get back to our car and get underway. We've been driving for better than an hour. And as the suspect in this case lives in another city some, 30 miles away. A moment ago, we stopped at a local police station and picked up another one of their officers to go in with us. This is customary courtesy when you're working out of your district. It's just a matter of blocks now, but before we do, I want to lean over the front seat here for just a moment. Sergeant, I noticed that when the lieutenant assigned us to this case, he seemed a little more concerned than usual. Any particular reason?
Well, yes, Don. I think what he had in mind was that in this type of a case where you've got a man exposing himself to either women or children, you've got a man that is usually mentally ill.
Mm-hmm.
And this coupled with the fact that many serious crimes, including even murder, will start with this kind of a background.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it doesn't have to be premeditated, but quite often the victim will scream or will fight. And as a result, the suspect, in his panic, he may injure the victim or do her great bodily harm. And even in some cases, as I said, the results will be homicide.
Oh, I see. Well, that's why Lieutenant Lugo is so anxious that we pick up this person.
That's it. Let's see. This should be about the house along here. Wait a minute. That looks like the car out there. Yeah. This is it here.
This is it.
Okay.
Uh,
Kurt, I'm going to cover the back door. Do you want to hold in the front with the lieutenant?
Yeah.
Approaching the house now. Young lady coming up to meet us at the door. The suspect is stretched out on a divan, listening to the radio. Young fellow, nice looking. In the corner, a couple of young girls playing with dolls. The police lieutenant from this local city right here is identifying us.
Here's
my identification.
You gentlemen from Culver City?
You got your car out in front?
Yeah.
I'd like to take you along back to Culver City for some questioning with regard to crime that occurred in Culver City.
Do you suppose I'll be able to go to work tonight?
You won't make it tonight.
Isn't that funny, Sergeant? He's not even curious why we're picking him up.
He knows why we're here.
Yeah, but if I were being arrested, I'd at least ask why.
That's an important piece of evidence. He knows he's committed a crime, so he's not even going to ask why.
Hmm. Is the young lady here his wife?
No, I was just talking to her. That's his sister-in-law.
Hmm.
Seems his wife works. We'll talk to her later.
Oh. What about the two youngsters over here? They belong to him?
Yeah, he's the father of two children.
Mm-hmm. You know, somehow he doesn't fit the crime. Nice looking, well dressed. Could be the young fellow that lives next door.
Here he is. You ready to go, fella?
Why are you calling, Daddy?
Well, Daddy, be back. Going to go see Mommy.
Bye.
I'll see you.
Be right back.
Well, we have the suspect in custody heading back now for our car.
Mommy?
We'll ride up in front with Sergeant Perkins. Detective Walter will sit in the back with the prisoner.
Appreciate very much for your cooperation, your department's cooperation.
I'll give you guys a ring on that deal. I'm very glad to have met you, sir.
My pleasure. Thank you, Lieutenant.
If we can help you anytime, let us know.
Okay.
Thank you. Good night, sir. Good night.
She is in Culver City the last couple days.
She's a little wife, so we'll pick her up.
What time do you pick your wife up?
Well,
you pick up.
Oh, I don't.
You have no idea at all. Why don't you think a little bit about what's happened? Start giving us the truth. You know why we're down here just as well as we do. We wouldn't come down and pick you out of 3 million people in the county of Los Angeles if we didn't know what we were doing.
Yeah.
You know that. So why don't you tell us?
Well, I can well imagine. There's only one thing that I can possibly imagine what it would be, and I can't imagine it could be that.
What is it that you imagine?
Well, why don't you tell me, and then if you're right, I'll tell you.
Well, you know why we're down here. Why don't you tell us? We've heard this story before from others, too.
Well, I haven't committed any crime that I know of.
Well, what have you done?
Well, I'm kind of embarrassed about the whole thing.
Doesn't embarrass us any. We've talked to people before on the same subject.
Well, a girl on the street corner saw me last night when I was... Do I have to say it?
You tell us. What were you doing?
Sounds kind of silly when you say it.
Did you expose yourself to her?
Well, I didn't expose myself to her. I think she saw me.
What were you doing?
But I didn't intend for her to see me because I didn't see her standing there until I turned around, and then she was standing there. I guess she was waiting for a bus or something, and so I turned right away as soon as I saw that she was standing there.
You mean you had your private parts exposed?
Yes.
When the girl was standing alongside the car?
Well, I suppose she was. Either she walked up or she was standing there. I didn't notice her.
Try to attract her attention to you?
No, I didn't. I went around the block and I came back by to see if she, you know, was looking and trying to see whether she had noticed or not. But
have you ever exposed yourself in the car just to yourself?
possibly.
Well, do you do it when you're driving, too?
I suppose maybe I have at one time or another, but I mean,
Do you feel this urge to just stop and park all by yourself?
Well, occasionally, yes, I might say so. I kind of have my own views about that. If I feel I want relief, well, that's the easiest way I know to get it. We all do stupid and silly things sometimes, and each one has their own fault.
When you get this urge, do you ever stop to consider the surroundings or the area in which you're in or anybody being able to see you?
Well,
or is the urge
I might say, naturally, I mean, to a certain extent, I don't make any bones about heading off someplace to try to get to some particular spot or so on to do it. I always try to be very careful about having no one see me. Naturally, I mean, you don't want anybody to see you doing anything like that. But I certainly never thought that I would ever be picked up for doing anything like that.
Against the law.
You mean it's against the law if nobody sees you?
Let's see, somebody saw you.
Well, I don't know.
That's why we're down here, to pick you up.
Naturally, I understand that.
We wonder how many cases have happened in the past in various localities that the police were not fortunate to obtain a license number or a description of the car, where there are outstanding crimes have been committed. 5-6, in with one. Will you open the booking door?
10-4-5-6.
You are listening to Night Watch and following the activities of a detective unit on their tour of duty. The people you hear are not actors, and every voice and every sound is real. The investigations are recorded as they actually occur. We will give you the final results of tonight's case at the conclusion of The Night Watch. And now we switch you back to police headquarters and police recorder Don Reed.
We've been here at headquarters for over an hour. The prisoner has been booked and placed in his cell. The suspect's wife has been called to the station. Sergeant Perkins and Detective Walter are in the office now discussing the case with her. Let's go on in. She's, sitting at the desk. Small in stature. Early 20s. Modestly dressed. Attractive. Sort of a bewildered expression on her
but
face.
He does park the car, and then he goes with these fellows that he shares a ride with. Where did this occur?
Here in Culver City.
I mean, he's not even in this vicinity.
Has he ever come up in this area?
Well, no.
He doesn't?
I mean, unless he comes after me.
I see.
And then I'm never at work that late.
Uh-huh.
This
what
is
time, what time
the reason we're late tonight is because I was trying to get information on him tonight.
Mm-hmm. And what time did he pick you up last night about?
It was about 6:30.
Did you notice anything unusual about him last night?
No.
Was he at all nervous or anything?
No.
Well, he was involved in an incident last night prior to the time that he picked you up.
I just can't imagine that.
But how long have you been married?
4 years.
4 years. Have children?
Yes, I have two, and I'm expecting another one.
May I ask you a personal question?
Certainly.
How do you and your husband get along?
Perfect.
No disharmony or trouble?
No, we've always gotten along perfect. Were these children or grown-ups or what?
Well, these were adults.
Well, I'm just shocked. I mean, we have two children. I guess you saw them, who picked them up. My sister said they were crying. But, I haven't noticed anything different about him. I mean, he's always the same. He's very attentive to the children and myself. And he's been a good husband, as you know, and a father. I've never deprived him of anything, and I can't imagine anything like this. When could I see him or talk to him?
Well, it'd be better if you wait until Monday. So do you feel that you want to get a lawyer?
I can't afford one.
Well, I don't think you absolutely need one until we finish the investigation and you can see where you stand.
Mm-hmm.
And if you feel that you need a lawyer, you can hire yourself one.
Or, if necessary, you can continue service as a public defender.
So he'll be held here?
If you contact the department Monday, I will have more information regarding it.
Okay, we'll come along with you then.
Good night.
Yeah, thank you.
Did you tell him to go in his office? Okay, wait a minute. Here he is now. Never mind.
Lieutenant Walter and I have been talking to this fellow, and he admits the accusations of the case. He appears to be a fairly intelligent man and normal in all appearance, but talking to him, well, you can tell he's got quite a psychiatric problem there, that something should be done on it. Now, we're just about ready to make out the reports on him and wanted to talk to you to see what you recommend in it.
Well, Perk, you've checked into his background, and if he has a problem, I would suggest that you mention that in your reports and to the district attorney, and possibly it may lead to giving him some help in his particular case.
Well, he is perfectly willing to get the help. He wants the help. He has no prior criminal record, but talking to him in his background, well, you can see he has this problem that has existed for some time.
Excuse me, Lieutenant, while you're making out these reports, I'd like to go over for a moment and talk with the prisoner about some of the points you've discussed here just now. Sorry with you.
Surely, go right ahead.
Fine, thanks.
One thing on the report before I get out. Statements have been recorded for police testimony as well as for the radio program Night Watch. And I'd like to have your permission to use this entire case for broadcast purposes, if that's all right with you.
Okay.
Now that you're alone here in the cell, I'd like to know how you really feel about this thing. Oh, I don't want to discuss the possibility of mental illness or that you're a family man, wife, children. However, I noticed in the car you stated that you felt that you had not committed a crime. I think now that you realize that you have. But somewhere, possibly, there are other people suffering from this same compulsion. So if you had a chance to speak of your experience, what would you say to them? What would you tell them?
All I have to say is that, if there's anyone, if this happens to strike anyone that might be listening to it, just, if you can take anybody's word for it, take mine. That it isn't any of it worth it. It just isn't worthwhile. No matter what the crime may be, to that, in that line, and no matter what satisfaction a person might get out of it, it certainly isn't worth it. It isn't worth an ounce of what you have to go through if you should ever get caught. Now, I want to say this much, that I've been treated pretty nice by all the officers since I've been here. But boy, when they come into your house and you wait and go to work, they tell you, come on, let's go. Don't even take a belt with you because they'll take it away. That right there is enough proof that it isn't worthwhile.
Okay. Good night.
You have been listening to Actual Investigations as recorded from Detective Unit 5-6 on The Night Watch. And now back to police headquarters and Chief W.N. Hildebrand.
Tonight's case involving the indecent exposure brings to mind that these suspects remain at large for long periods because the victims either feel embarrassment and fail to report the incident or provide the police with little or no description. In that event, your law enforcement officers are powerless to apprehend them. We must depend on the citizen and their cooperation to control this problem. In the case heard tonight, it was apparent the suspect was in need of mental treatment. This fact was included in the officer's report, and the court directed the prisoner be given treatment as part of his sentence. Consequently, when this man is released, he'll be ready to take his place in normal society. It is my honest opinion that the average citizen does not realize the real problems facing the law enforcement officer today or the dangers they encounter to maintain public security. That's why we are bringing you the facts as they actually happen. If we succeed in bringing this message to just a few, then our efforts will be well rewarded in presenting Night Watch.
Thank you, Chief Hildebrand. You have just heard on-the-scene reports of your police force in action. Every voice, every sound has been real. Night Watch, brought to you through the cooperation of your police department of Culver City, California, is produced by Sterling Tracy and Jim Headlock, with technical advice by Sergeant Ron Perkins, and described in the field by police recorder Don Reed.
Night Watch, on Tuned to Yesterday, from the 12th of April, 1954, on CBS. This is an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now time for a broadcast of Up for Parole, bringing true-to-life cases dramatized to air. Directed by Mitchell Grayson, who has one of the more interesting resumes of radio's past. Based in New York, he directed such shows as the Civil Rights Program, New World a Coming, the Federal Theater Plays Program, and later in his career, in a national capacity, he directed broadcasts of Dick Tracy and the sci-fi show Beyond Tomorrow, at the same time during Up for Parole. This story is called The Case of Harold Edgerton, heard on CBS on April 21st, 1950.
State your name and prison number.
Harold Edgerton II. Prison number 210-37.
And your age, please?
46 last month.
Well, you don't look it, Edgerton. Prison life agrees with you.
Oh, no, sir. I just tried to take care of myself, sir. I feel the years even if I don't look it.
Charges on which you were convicted?
Armed robbery, defrauding an insurance company.
Sentence now being served.
10 to 20 years.
You may proceed.
Having served 3 years and 7 months, and having the kind permission of Warden Halliday, I am up for parole.
Up for Parole. Tonight, another in the exciting new crime series based on authentic cases actually heard by parole boards in our state prisons, reenacted here for the first time. And now, Harry Marble.
You are about to sit in judgment on another human being's freedom, to decide whether he shall become your neighbor, your employee, perhaps your friend, or whether he shall remain where you, society, have put him, behind prison bars. For that human being is a social offender, a criminal, up for parole. The story you are about to hear is taken from the official records of Harold Edgerton II, prison number 210-37, now pleading before the parole board and before you for his freedom.
This opportunity as a privilege. For a prisoner to be able to present his case as he sees it with honesty and frankness is, in my opinion, what makes this democracy of ours strong and great. And I hope that you will accept my statement in the spirit in which it is delivered, with full frankness and the full honesty of which I am capable.
That is precisely what we're interested in.
Until 3.5 years ago, 4 years ago, I was a respected and, I might say in all modesty, a well-liked human being. I owned my own home, mortgage-free. I had a business. I inherited it from my father, Harold Edgerton Associates Real Estate. I had not one outstanding obligation, and I counted my friends, I think it's accurate to say, in the hundreds.
Well, these facts are all known to us, Edgerton. But what we want to know from you is, why did you, a respected, responsible, dependable family man, commit armed robbery and defraud an insurance company?
The answer, perhaps, is that I had too good a life. Had life, gentlemen, can you understand it? It was fine, but it was dull.
Dull?
I know. It sounds like a schoolboy talking, but I always read the magazines, gentlemen. Time, Fortune, the story of the giants of America. They took chances. They gambled and they won. A little audacity, a little vision. This is the difference between mediocrity and greatness. Call it neurotic, if you like, but I had this drive.
Then it wasn't speculation. It wasn't business deals that got you started on this.
No, sir. Would that it were. It was something much more common, much more vulgar. It was gambling. How many times I stood at the gambling tables and watched without betting a dime. And finally, I had some excess cash. I sat down at a table, roulette, in the house of the notorious gambler, Clifford Chazen, and lost $6,000. When I got up to leave, Chazen asked me to come into his office.
Sit down, Mr. Edgerton.
Thank you.
Mr. Edgerton, I've been watching you. $6,000 is a lot of money to lose for one who's never gambled before. But I've studied up on you. You have a fine real estate business. Manner and appearance, you're everything that could be desired.
Well, just what are you getting at, sir?
How would it be if you were to pay that debt to me without an expenditure from your own pocket?
The $6,000? What are you driving at?
Just this. I speak carefully and confidentially to you, sir. Supposing one night, say tomorrow night, you had occasion to leave in your safe, the one in your inside office, securities in the amount of $6,000. And supposing quite by accident, your safe was robbed.
Go on.
Supposing three armed bandits were to rifle your safe tomorrow night, find those securities and make off with them. You carry insurance, don't you?
Of course, but
then the debt would be settled. The insurance company would be out some $6,000 and you won't lose a penny. It's quite simple. It's been done before.
But that's robbery, sir. Defrauding the insurance company, that's criminal.
You prefer to pay the money out of your own pocket, then suit yourself, Mr. Edgerton. It's up to you. You don't have much vision, do you, Mr. Edgerton?
What shall I say, gentlemen of the board, to explain what I did? I was weak. I was avaricious. I was grasping. I could scarcely afford the $6,000 loss, and so later that night I called Chazen on the phone and said there would be $6,600 in railroad stocks in the safe.
You see how easy it was?
Yes.
And here you are, sir. $600.
I don't understand.
The debt was $6,000. The securities came to $6,600. The difference is yours.
Well, sir, I've got to get home.
Oh, stay a moment. You see, we aren't quite finished.
I am quite finished.
Just an idea I had, Mr. Edgerton. See what you think of it. After all, one doesn't need a gambling debt to make such an arrangement as we made last night. Suppose it was just to happen without the gambling debt, and suppose I was to offer you 30% of whatever we found in somebody else's safe the next time.
What do you mean?
Simply this. I know that you're friendly with quite a number of real estate firms. You have an idea, I'm certain, which ones keep securities in their safes. All I need to know, my organization, that is where and when and roughly how much. 70% is my share, 30% is yours.
I won't do it.
You don't have to answer right now. Why don't you think it over? Let me know what you decide in the morning, eh?
Gentlemen of the board, I should have gone to the police right then and there. I should have called a stop to the filthy business at that moment.
Oh, why didn't you, Edgerton? That's what this board wants to know.
What can I say, sir? Men are weak. I was weak. And there was a kind of intoxication, a tremendous kind of excitement. Many would have resisted it. I couldn't.
Didn't you ever stop to think of your family?
Oh, yes, sir, I did. My wife is fine a woman as man could ever have. My son, Harold Edgerton III, he bears my father's name as I do. I thought of them, and I thought, if they find out, the disgrace will ruin them, shame them. Then there were my clients, people dependent upon me, small investors. They, too, would be ruined, so I never went to the police.
And now you see the false wisdom of that decision.
Oh, yes, sir, of course. But which of us, if he thinks he sees a way out, will face the music? In Jason's gang, I was called the chief. I was the front man. He, of course, was the real power. We bought a cabin cruiser. It was docked in Lake Michigan, and after a job was over, we would meet aboard the boat, cruise out into the lake, and divide the loot. It was a magnificent ruse, our floating headquarters, for who would think to look for criminals aboard a $60,000 cruiser rigged for deep-sea fishing, a pleasure boat? And so my career as chief began.
Not bad, chief.
No, I would say it was very good, Jason.
My guess is that this jewelry is worth $13,000.
Whatever you say.
Oh, whatever you say, chief. I think the next thing you're going to say is the vault at the Farmer's Realty.
It was the most efficient operation I had ever seen. The Farmer's Realty. The take, $22,000.
Oh, I think, Chief, a private home on the north side. Maybe the Griffith Mansion.
Oh, this has got to stop, Jason.
We never use the same pattern, do we, Chief? Robbery today, a heist in a bank tomorrow, job in a private home the next day. That's your idea, isn't it, Chief?
I won't do it. Tom Griffith is a friend of mine.
It's friendlier with friends.
I went along with you. 2-3 jobs, but when is it going to stop? I tell you, I won't do it, Jason.
What I've got on you, Edgerton, you'll do it.
I was trapped, hopelessly trapped. And then Jason put forth the next step.
We understand each other?
Do we have to?
We have to, Chief. This is the finest insurance in the world.
Just be sure you do it right.
Harold, it was a lovely play. A lovely evening. Didn't you adore the music?
Yes, that was fine, Helen.
Come in the living room, darling. Let's have a drink. Harold, my picture. The safe is...
No. Oh,
your papers. The bonds. My earrings, my necklace. Harold, this is horrible.
Sit down, my dear. I'll handle this. Give me the police immediately.
Oh,
Hello, police? My house has been robbed. I thought, gentlemen of the board, that with the robbery of my own home, I had reached the lowest point in my life.
Yes, Edgerton?
And I found, gentlemen, that I had not. Heaven help me, it was only the beginning. What, you may ask, can be more heinous than defrauding an insurance company? Armed robbery of a friend's home and then robbing your own home. And I answer, gentlemen, what I did next.
What are you saying?
I mean murder, sir. Cold, brutal, calculated murder.
We will return to our file in just a moment, but first, the King of the Cowboys, Gene Autry, will be riding high with song and Western drama on CBS again tomorrow night. And Vaughn Monroe's Caravan will also be riding along with the 5 top tunes of the week, plus favorites of another college fraternity. The Gene Autry Show and Vaughn Monroe's Caravan are regular Saturday features of most of these same CBS stations. Back to the true story of Harold Edgerton II, the prison case number 210-37. The man who is up for parole.
All right now, Edgerton, you've made a shocking statement to this board. You said the next step in your career was murder.
Yes, sir.
Just a moment now. You were never charged with murder?
No, sir, I was
not. What are you saying? What are you trying to tell this board?
I'm saying, sir, that I might as well have been charged with murder. Because I... In my own mind, that's what I committed. Murder. It began with the biggest haul in the gang's existence. It began, as everything did, with Chazen. He had me call the gang together on the boat.
All right, now. Absolute quiet. Absolute attention. Chief will explain the plan. Floor is yours, Chief.
Well, the building is the Mercantile Trust at South and at 7th.
What's the matter, Chief?
What is it?
You better go on, Chazen.
Chief isn't feeling too good. Just sit back and take it easy, Chief. Stop me if I say anything wrong, okay?
Okay.
Can I get you something? Maybe an aspirin?
He'll be all right. Just listen. This time it's going to be the top 15 floors of the entire building. No more once sweet jobs. 15 floors.
Wow.
That's right. Wow. The chief cooks up a plan. It's a plan. At 11 o'clock at night, there are 8 people in the building. 6 cleaning women, 1 elevator operator, 1 guard. The guard is about 65. They call him Pop.
Yeah, he'll be a cinch.
Gotcha.
Now, at 1:05, the 6 cleaning women leave. And all that's left is...
the operator and Pop.
Right. The operator goes off duty at 2 a.m. Before he does regularly... check me on this, Chief. He brings a container of coffee for Pop, who's the only man in the building after 2 a.m.
That's correct.
Now, if there was something in the coffee... say, maybe a pill or something...
Gotcha. That's terrific. How are you feeling now, Chief?
I'm all right.
But you'll be a lot better when the job's done, won't you?
That's right.
Okay, we do it. We meet back here in the boat at 3:20. Job's done, the boat kicks off. Did I get everything right, Chief?
Fine, Chief. Just fine.
Hey, Pop. Here's the office. Here's the coffee.
Thanks.
Well, I'm knocking off. Tough day. See that nobody walks off of the building, eh, Pop?
He's out like a light, Jason. You'll be sleeping till tomorrow noon.
All right, Tony. Come on, let's go.
Hey, hold it down. Not so loud.
Let them make all the noise they want, Tony. This place belongs to us. Did you get the 31st floor?
Yeah, got it.
Okay. Tony, get them going on 27 hour.
Right.
27th floor, securities.
$12,000. You been able to figure how much?
Where do we get to the boat, Tony? Don't count your chickens here in the elevator.
Job case as well as this? Nothing to worry about.
Look at Pop. Asleep like a baby. Good night, Pop.
Yeah, he'll read about it in the papers tomorrow. Now let's get back to the boat.
Yeah, 3 o'clock. I hope this doesn't grow into a real storm.
What are you worried about, Edgerton?
The wind is blowing and the rain. It's a dreadful night to be out on the water.
Pour yourself a drink. Ought to be right to catch the news now, and we ought to be on it.
I hope Tony's all right. I sent him out on deck to get some air. He's awful seasick.
Here he comes.
The embassy announced tonight, and that's the news on the international scene. And now at home, police have just announced one of the most daring robberies in the history of this city.
There it is.
14 offices in the Mercantile Trust building were stripped between the hours of 2 and 3 a.m. this morning of jewelry, merchandise, and securities estimated at $600,000.
They're wrong. This stuff is worth
$1 million.
Police
were checking an important clue at the local airports, which indicated the band of robbers had left the city by plane. An early arrest is expected. And in Washington today, the Senate announced...
yes, sirree. An arrest is expected shortly at the airport. Great. You ever see anything like it in your life? We made history.
Tony in here, Chief.
Oh, I sent him out on deck a few minutes ago. Isn't he out there?
He's on the boat. I looked all over.
Is it blowing badly?
Yeah, the wind's up.
Stop worrying. He'll show up.
Well, could he fall over, maybe?
That's what happened. Stop the engine. Tony's gone over. We got to find him.
You get out of here.
Me?
That's right, you. And don't stop the engine.
Yeah, but the Chief...
you heard me outside.
What's the matter with you, Chazen? A man falls overboard. What are you going to do? Just go off
that's
and...
that's right. Forget about him. What do you think I'm going to do? Start shining searchlights on the water at 3 a.m?
But we can't let him drown.
No, we can just get ourselves picked up by the Coast Guard or the police patrol.
That's
murder, Chisholm.
Do me a favor, Edgerton. Forget the morality. It doesn't become you.
Gentlemen, as clearly as if I had put a gun to that boy's head and pulled the trigger, I murdered him. He was a decent kid. A robber, yes, but a decent person.
It was shortly after that that you were picked up.
That's right, sir. It was about a month later. How I lived during that month, what rationalizations and justifications I gave to myself, it's impossible to describe. But I hoped what happened would happen.
Did you be arrested?
Yes, sir. Tony's body was washed ashore, and he was tied in with Chazen. A stool pigeon did that. As you know, Chazen was the first member of the gang arrested, and for whatever reasons, I can't presume to know what goes on inside the mind of a man like Chazen, but he kept his mouth shut about my connection with the operation. Then they found Tony's hat.
Inside the hat band, a phone number.
That's correct, sir. My private number, in case he got into trouble. Gentlemen, when the arresting officers came, I knew relief for the first time in the many months I had been part of Chazen's gang. And in the years that followed, these years here in prison, I spent that time atoning for the many guilts which I freely admit. The guilt of my wife, my son, my daughter, my clients, to Tony, to society.
Uh-huh. That's how it happened.
Yes, sir. Now, if you like, if it pleases the board, I would like to make one final statement. I'm reluctant to do this, but...
Well, what is it, Edgerton?
I want to read a letter from my wife, sir.
You may read it.
Dear Harold, at the time of the trial, when I learned for the first time that you were involved in those terrible things, you know how shocked I was. That a gentle, generous, fine man like yourself could have this side to his character. Shall I continue, gentlemen?
Yes, finish the letter, please.
But now I have had time to think, and I begin to understand how such a thing is possible. Let me tell you now, my darling, for your own peace of mind. When you come out, and I know no parole board in the land will ask you to serve your full term when they have heard your story, then when you come out, my darling, we shall be waiting. Helen, Harold III, and Ellen. That's all, gentlemen.
You were a victim then, Edgerton, of human frailty. Ordinary human weakness. Is that what we're to understand?
I tried to say it as honestly as I knew how, sir.
Having made the initial error of involvement with Chazen, you became his victim, his tool. And the rest flowed logically from this terrible premise?
I would like not to repeat myself, sir. That is what happened.
As you're well aware, there's another inmate inside this prison, well known to you, Clifford Chazen.
Yes, sir, I know.
It's known to this board that you have, during your imprisonment, stayed away from Chazen, never exchanged a word with him in the past 3.5 years.
I tried my best, sir.
I'm going to take a liberty with the normal procedure of this board and bring this man into the hearing. Guard, show Chazen in, please.
I want to caution you, sir. This man is a fantastic liar.
Over there, Chazen. Next to the chairman.
Chazen, you're aware that you were picked up in connection with the mercantile trust theft on the word of a stool pigeon?
That's right.
You're also aware, probably by now, of the name of that stool pigeon.
That's right. Freddie Galante from Detroit.
Let me add to your store of information, Chazen. The name of the man who informed on you was Harold Edgerton II.
What?
That's a lie.
Silence! The question is addressed to you, answer. Otherwise, absolute silence. Now, Chazen, who masterminded the gang? Whose gang was it? Who, in fact, was the chief?
So you stole on me. You're the one. All these years, I kept my mouth shut. All these years. What have you been telling him? All right, I'll tell him. Sure, in the beginning, I brought him into the organization. But after that, it was his idea. Every safe job, every stick-up, every house we knocked over, he cased them. He planned them. What's he been telling you?
I have said my piece, gentlemen.
Did you tell him about knocking over your own house? Did you tell him how you wanted one of the boys to do it while your wife was there to make it look more authentic? To knock her down, rough her up, maybe break her arm? Did you tell him that?
The man's a pathological liar.
Did you tell him how you killed Tony? Did you tell him how when he fell overboard I wanted to search for him, even if it was risky? Not what you said?
No. Tell them what I said, Jason.
You said, what's one death when you're making history? That's what you said, well...
Not another word, either of you. Now, one last question. Harold Edgerton, what have you to say to all this?
Will you keep him quiet, sir?
He'll be quiet. Guard, stand by this man. All right, proceed.
Gentlemen, this man standing here with me is one of the most cunning and desperate criminals I have ever met. You've just tasted a sample of his pathological lying. Of course I informed on him. I would do it again. He killed a man. Let me inform on him once more. Gentlemen, there is a prison break planned in this institution. Clifford Chazen planned that prison break.
Well, silence!
Special.
Silence! Are you finished, Adjutant?
Not quite, sir. I wish only to remind you that I was someone who felt the need for excitement and got involved terribly and desperately over my head. I did what I did out of fear and because I was a dupe. But if in your wisdom, gentlemen, you see fit to return me to society, I can only say that I believe I have learned my lesson. Let me go back to my family. My guilt will always be with me.
All right, Edgerton. The board will decide your case. Step outside with a guard.
While Harold Edgerton II waits and the parole board reviews his history, you too have a decision to make. In a moment, you can compare your decision with that of the actual parole board before which he appeared.
That amiable redhead Arthur Godfrey's got words and music aplenty for you every Saturday night when he rings up the curtain on another edition of the Arthur Godfrey Digest. Here's your chance to hear the music and merriment you may have missed on Godfrey's five-a-week CBS daytime show. Here's your chance to meet once again those special Godfrey guests. Here's your chance to enjoy a full 30 minutes with America's favorite ukulele player and commentator on things and stuff. That's the Arthur Godfrey Digest every Saturday night over most of these same CBS stations.
Now, the decision of the parole board in the case of Harold Edgerton II, prison number 210-37.
Edgerton, step out of that light. I want to see your face as I talk to you.
Yes, sir. This all right?
I have sat on parole boards for 19 years. In that long period of intense experience, I have met many hardened men. I've listened to men who boasted of stealing from the poor, petty racketeers. I've heard from men who vandalized whole neighborhoods, beat their own families, their fathers, sisters, mothers. I can recall nearly two decades of lies and deceptions and cruelty. But never in my time have I sat and listened to a man so thoroughly corrupt, so utterly, viscerally dishonest as yourself.
Sir,
I want silence. Yes, I've seen men con others out of their life savings, but I have never seen an individual attempt so loud, so vulgar a job of confidence as you've tried before this board.
I only meant
to try. To try to con a parole board. Hardly a single word of what you said was truth. It was you who planned the robberies, every one of them. It was you who was the chief, the brains. You who let Tony die. You who dared to introduce a letter here from your wife, a letter written, this board well knows, over 2 years ago and since disowned. Your wife has divorced you, Edgerton. Your children disown you. And yet you have the incredible effrontery to stand before this board and urge that we grant you clemency based on a fraud. You informed on your own henchman, Jason. You denounced him as a pathological liar, and you blandly tell us that he is planning a prison break. You were planning the prison break. You, Edgerton. We have information from the grapevine, and we know. You've done yourself an incredible disservice. Had you told us the truth as it happened, this board might have been inclined to listen to you. But now, knowing you, I can tell you that you shall not appear before a parole board in this state until such time as you've served your minimum prison sentence of 10 years. I'm sorry you've learned nothing from 3.5 years of incarceration. Parole denied. Next case.
Harold Edgerton II is still in prison, and he will be there for many years to come, as will any prisoner who attempts to peddle a lie to a parole board. We have told his story tonight so that all may understand the extremely difficult and crucial tasks parole boards of this nation face. And we have told it in the interest of the thousands of men and women in American prisons who may themselves someday be up for parole.
You have been listening to Up for Parole, with Bernard Lenroe as Harold Edgerton and Santos Ortega as Clifford Chasen, written by Arnold Pearl and produced and directed by Mitchell Grayson. Research by Wally Gould. Music was under the direction of Harry Salter. Listen again at this same time next week when CBS will bring you the actual story of prison case number 13033-B. Up for Parole.
Up for Parole, on Tuned to Yesterday from the 21st of April, 1950 on CBS. Wrapping up this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great shows from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening.